Good morning. I'm reading from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19, 1 to 10, in which we hear the story of Zacchaeus and Jesus. He entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be the guest of the one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the human one came to seek out and to save the lost." May God bless this reading to our hearing and to our understanding.
Let us pray. Dear God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. A couple of weeks ago, I visited the 9/11 Museum and Memorial in New York City. I just read Garrett Graff's powerful book about that day called The Only Plane in the Sky, and I felt I had to go visit the site. Being in the museum, as many of you may know, is wrenching. What struck me the moment I descended the escalator was the smell of smoke. Was this the power of suggestion, I wondered? Are they pumping smoke into the museum to enhance the experience of those who visit? I've done some research and found no mention of this peculiar aspect of the museum. What I've decided is that it smells of smoke simply because so many items in the exhibit were burned. Fire trucks, stairways, steel beams, walls. 18 years later, the smell of smoke is present and as real as the stories that are told. We learn and we absorb things through our senses, all of them, and there's something especially infusing about what we smell because we take it into our bodies and not into our brains. The memorial that is outside and pictured on the cover of your bulletin this morning was riveting. As great works of art do, it mirrors our feelings and our emotion. It gives form to something that we can't clearly articulate, to something we can't express in a particularly rational or intellectual way. For those of you who've not visited the site, the two pools, the largest human-made waterfalls in North America, cover the exact footprints of the two original Twin Towers. The water cascades off the walls onto a flat surface and finally down into a dark well. The endless flowing of water is so reflective of our own deep, unabating sorrow and tears. As I stood by the memorial with the early morning sun just peeking around the skyscrapers onto the pool, I had a very practical problem. I'm not the tallest person on the block, and I really wanted to see into the final hole. I wanted to see where all that water was going. I wanted to see the bottom. But the wall surrounding the pool is very deep, holding the names on the edge of all the victims. And it was about chest high up to me. And though I tried jumping up, I could not better my view. I wondered if tall people, if Lane, for instance, would be able to see into it. And I suspect that they would not. And maybe that's the unsettling, disconcerting intention. There is no end to sorrow, this shared and born profound sadness. Much as we might like to reassure ourselves by seeing the delineated boundary, the bottom of the well of tears, we can't. I feel and still feel when I recall it that the ground that I was standing on was shifting sand. And right about now, you may be well wondering what in the world this has to do with Zacchaeus. So bear with me as we look at this story of Luke. There's simply no getting around the fact that the gospel of Jesus Christ is to the poor. The disenfranchised, the lepers, the foreigners, the rejects are the ones to whom Jesus comes, the ones who need the good news. And I don't like to face this. In fact, when I read passages that speak of the rewards of heaven going to those who have been poor in their earthly lives, it doesn't take much of a mathematical mind, which is good because I don't have one, to realize the other end of the equation. Those who have been rich on earth have had theirs already. No, I think I just won't focus on this right now. Or perhaps I can twist this passage so that it all works out for me. But as Scarlett O'Hara said so wisely, I'll worry about that tomorrow. Zacchaeus was not poor. He was rich, really rich. And his wealth was not honestly won. He wasn't just a tax collector. He was the head of the IRS. He was Charles Reddick, who will incidentally collect in the neighborhood of $2.5 trillion this year. All the tax collectors worked for Zacchaeus. He was the chief, and he was aligned with the Roman authorities that the Jews viewed with such loathing and suspicion. In the first century, the whole system was shady. Zacchaeus took the money, probably kept a sizable portion for himself, and then he gave some to the Romans. He was the original Bernie Madoff, a Ponzi scheme impresario. He was corrupt and greedy and exceptionally wily. He was very important, a big person, probably a bit rough, but we're also told that he was short. A short person. I can't help but think that if a movie were being made of this story, that Danny DeVito would play his part. The other lead character in the story is, of course, Jesus, who is passing, we're told, through Jericho. Minor parts are played by the gathered elite, some rabbis, perhaps some disciples, people of good standing in the community. Hearing that Jesus is coming to town, Zacchaeus is eager to get a look at him, but there is such a large crowd lining the streets that Zacchaeus, vertically challenged as he is, can't see a thing. Kind of like me in the memorial. He's clever and determined and runs ahead and scoots, if you can imagine Bernie Madoff or Danny DeVito scooting, up a sycamore tree and out on a limb to get a better view. You have to wonder why someone like Zacchaeus cared so much about seeing Jesus. From this point on, the story is perplexing. Jesus walks in, sees Zacchaeus up in the tree, and tells him to come down quickly so he can go to his house and have dinner and a sleepover. Zacchaeus probably just about fell off his perch. We're told that he received Jesus joyfully. This shady character, who is in a position of great power, is tickled pink to be noticed by Jesus. Understandably, the crowds are flummoxed. Hang on, they say. What is he doing embracing this sinner? They do their kind of famous holier-than-thou crowd murmur thing, looking disapprovingly at both Zacchaeus and Jesus. These are the characters in the story that intrigue me. The people who thought they knew what was right and what was wrong. They have been doing their best, upholding the laws, trying to be faithful, interested in the message this odd carpenter is telling. They have shown up, some to learn, some to be with friends, some to be seen, some to refute, perhaps. A bit like all of us this morning, who have shown up for many of the same reasons. We are a crowd circling around Jesus, eager to learn what his message has to do with our lives. We all want to know, with varying degrees of curiosity and tension, what exactly would it look like to follow Jesus? How might our lives change or unfold? The trouble is that Jesus shakes the ground, the moral high ground on which we stake our claim. He has a habit of doing this. And we'd be wise to be wary whenever we take a moral stand, because he might just be in the corner having a falafel with our enemy. How would you feel if Jesus singled out someone you can't abide and eagerly asked to go home with them, acted as if they were buddies and on the same side? What if the person on that limb were President Trump or Bernie Sanders or Nancy Pelosi or Vladimir Putin? Jesus is over the moon to go to Mar-a-Lago for the weekend. No matter what your political or ethical inclination, it is your perceived enemy that Jesus chooses. Hospitality was very important in the first century. You can be sure that most of those standing under the sycamore tree had cleaned their houses and prepared a lovely spread just in case Jesus might choose to go to their house. They had preened and cleaned and cooked in the hope that, given their support and faithfulness, they would be chosen. In their dualistic view of the world, there are good guys and bad guys. There are rich and there is right and there is wrong. There is the in crowd and there are outsiders. What Jesus does in singling out Zacchaeus is to debunk that way of thinking, as he so often does. Where the crowd loathes the tax collector, Jesus embraces him. It doesn't really make sense in our moral order of things. How do you think the crowd felt? They were no doubt shocked and surprised and hurt and maybe indignant and affronted. When we dare to entertain the humanity of those with whom we disagree, and the broader unifying message of Christ's love that infiltrates all creation and all people, we too can feel unsettled and unhinged. It becomes really hard when we do this to choose sides, to either attach ourselves to one position or another, or conversely, to detach ourselves completely. We can't just simply say, life is wonderful, and turn a blind eye to disagreements and conflict. We must dare to rest in that shifting, transient space of unknowing. Our egos, by the way, don't like this at all. We want clarity and affirmation. We want to know where we stand and what we stand for. We want to see the bottom of the well of tears. When we venture into that kind of holy in-between space where we endeavor to see those with whom we disagree, we will inevitably feel unstable and disoriented. This is the space where Jesus dwells and where he bids us venture. Spiritual practices are a way of resting in this holy in-between space. But if you're new to doing this, it can be unsettling. You sit down to meditate and pray, and if you're like me, you feel immediately compelled to get up and empty the dishwasher. Your mind may race to fill the quiet space that you are trying so desperately to enter. Eventually, though, by trying again and again to attune your heart and your body to this way of being and calming your monkey mind, you will find yourself perhaps knowing less and sensing more. Some of us sit and meditate. Some pray, some do a walking meditation. Whatever practice you consider, the key is to show up. Maybe for just 5 minutes a day to start, because Christ is already there waiting to keep you company. When the crowd saw Jesus call to Zacchaeus and then affirm his transformation and commitment to give away some of his wealth, their worldview was shaken. They were confronted with the outrageous idea that God's love really is expressed in welcoming the stranger and loving one's enemies, not from a position of power, but from humility, grace, and shared suffering and love. They felt rejected, perhaps a new feeling for them. Our hearts are stirred to this knowing all the time. The trick is to notice it, to wonder about it, to allow ourselves to be nudged into that holy in-between space of not knowing. I came away from my visit to the 9/11 site with the smell of smoke inside me. Powerful though the stories, pictures, and relics were, it was the pervasive internalized smell of sadness, death, and destruction that filled me. Going out into the light and standing by the waterfall was profoundly moving. Was it cleansing, all that water? Some see it as a restorative symbol, and others a clear reflection of our country's endless flow of tears. What I felt more than saw was the aching soul of a nation, the people lost and the broken lives resulting, the endless grief flowing into that dark hole. But more than that, I felt the gentle comfort of shared sorrow and the tenderness of love, a love that cleanses and transforms us, especially in pain and suffering, the wellspring of God's redeeming and endless love. It is the core of our Christian faith. So as we observe All Saints' Day and think of those who have died and for whom we hold deep affection, I suspect there's not one we'd consider all saint and no sinner. Some of you might have been reluctant to offer up a name because you second-guessed yourself and thought, well, he was no saint. He had faults too. Try seeing this from Jesus' perspective. He's calling you down from your branch apart because he knows the goodness and the love within you, and he simply wants to share a meal with you. We are all saints and all sinners and all embraced by God's endless love, made real all around us. And look, Christ's table is set for you. Come, let's eat.